Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball here with you. It is nearly Christmas, Pete, and it's almost no longer Hanukkah. Tonight we just lit the candles with my kids for the last time for the year, and now getting ready to shift to the other holiday as we go through both of them. So we got a lot going on, but and you're on break, right?
Mercifully. Oh my God, am I on break?
Hopefully it'll be a good one. Chance to rest and recharge. But we are not on break. We've been off for a couple of weeks, which is sort of the off-season schedule here, but we put out a call for questions, and this started with us being like, we'll see if we get some questions, and if we get some questions, we'll answer them, and if not, we can go through some transactions. We got some other stuff to cover. I have a list of 19 questions we got, Pete, and because we haven't recorded for a couple of weeks and like everything happened over those 2 weeks, not even everything is done yet, but a lot happened. We have a lot of ground to cover. For our listeners who submitted questions, we are not going to get to all 19 of them. We can't. That's not possible. So we're going to get through, I don't know. I was going to say a number, and now I'm not going to say a number. We're going to get through some of them.
Done that in the past and immediately regretted it. So
yeah, that's right. Well, let's under promise and over deliver. We'll get through at least three questions and we'll see how far we get beyond that. And then we'll save the rest of these. We probably won't be back with you until after the new year. Probably we will not be back with you till after the new year. But when we are back, we've got a bunch of these questions. We will get to them. The nice thing is most of them not super time sensitive at the point they need to be answered this week right now, I hope. If you thought your question was crucial for today, I'm sorry. I don't know what else.
But also, it wasn't.
Yeah, but it wasn't. The off season is long. There's still time. But Pete, let's dive right in because this first question is it's such a simple question and yet it's a doozy of a one to answer because so much has happened. Cool from the Discord asking us, based on player movement so far in MLB, who do you see as risers in keeper value? And I think the best way to go about this, Pete, is to just go through a bunch of transactions that have happened. And because risers, there's also fallers here. And so let's talk about these transactions and who's rising in value, who's falling in value. And we're going to start with one that actually isn't on the rundown because it happened after I built the rundown for the show today. And that is Wilson Contreras on his way to Boston to join the Red Sox, maybe possibly finally solve that first base conundrum that's been there for what feels like a few years now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say this. I'm not going to put you on the spot and make you analyze your own team's acquisition first. And I'm just going to say, if you haven't yet, go to Baseball Savant, go to the Illustrator page on Wilson Contreras' page. Like, go to Wilson Contreras, click Illustrator, and overlay his 2025 hit chart, hits, outs, everything on Fenway Park. And just marvel at what he's going to do to the Green Monster, because that guy is going to pepper the Green Monster with so many balls next year. I think this park is going to be an awesome, awesome fit for him. I think it's a big lineup upgrade for him. I like everything about this for him. I think he is a riser in keeper value. Like, I think if you drafted already this year, like if you're one of those people who's like in an NFBC league that drafted in October or like, you know, June or something crazy like that. Just be glad if you're the one who took Wilson Contreras, because I think his value is going way up as we move forward.
Yeah. You know, when I was looking at this list, Chad, and like you said, you made it before the acquisition, I was like, man, I don't know if I really feel too strongly about any values really shifting this offseason. Yeah. And Mike Burrows came to mind, not that we're getting into him right now, but I think he's a second place for me. But at the risk of sounding like a homer, I think Wilson Contreras is the biggest riser, so far, which sounds weird to say because he's a first base / DH, like, you know, 33, 34 year old. And but when you consider where he's going to, you know, the park is one thing, but it's also a lineup upgrade. It's like a rejuvenation to his career. He still has good swing speed, all those tools that like you might think would be disappearing with age that really haven't yet with Wilson Contreras. He's going to be batting what looks like to be in a prime spot in the lineup, whereas in maybe some better lineups, he wouldn't be. So all of the opportunity is going to be there for him to post maybe one of his best fantasy seasons ever. Now, like factoring in catcher eligibility in previous seasons and maybe those being better seasons, obviously, you know, that's a conversation for another day. But just like by the 5x5 numbers, I could see this being maybe his best season ever. You know, for a story of a career he's had, last year was his highest RBI total at 80. And as shaky as the Red Sox offense might look, particularly with how much it's going to strike out, it's probably better than last year's Cardinals offense. So I kind of, what comes to mind for me, Chad, I don't know, you're an AL Central fan. He's not as good of a hitter, but Victor Martinez, a player who is like a tremendous hitter, later in his career transitions from basically, you know, he's not a catcher anymore to basically being a DH. Contreras is going to have first base. That helps him. But that just like allows him to prolong his bat much longer. His career obviously got rejuvenated really with Detroit. He had a great season with the Red Sox. Contreras kind of following that same kind of path here. And I could just see him aging pretty nicely and being a solid hitter in the middle of this lineup. Not elite power, but enough power, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is a good move for him. I think it's a good move for his value, his keeper value too, because he will be in Boston, barring another trade. He'll be in Boston at least this year and next. There's an option for 2028.
He still has the no trade clause too.
Yeah, and so he used that no trade clause to negotiate a little bit of extra financial incentive on this deal, and so. Yeah, I don't think he's going to want to move again. We'll see. But yeah, I like this a lot. Let's jump to another move. And I'm going to skip over the first one on our list to go to the second one, because you were saying you didn't see anything else that might be as comparable a value upgrade. And this is going to be a weird thing to say, but Munetaka Murakami, I think, ended up in a better situation than I imagined he would. And here's why I'm saying that. The White Sox are not a good team. I don't think I'm going out on a limb. I don't think it's a hot take. They're bad. It's a good park to hit in. There is no reason he shouldn't be in a good spot in that lineup if he's hitting. But I don't know if we've talked about Murakami much on the show, but I know like there's been a lot of talk out there about like he can't, you know, he swings through everything. His contact rates are terrible. Blah, blah, blah. Like, there are real questions, and I have real concerns about Murakami. If I'm thinking about it from a fantasy perspective, like, he is like a Spencer Jones type prospect for me, where you're like, prospect with big power, big K rates, hard to know what they're going to do. The thing I love about him being in Chicago is both a good, like I said, good park to hit in, and the White Sox are not trying to win. I mean, eventually they might be, but right now they're not, which means they can afford to let him struggle. And he might struggle, but he's not going to get better if he doesn't go through that struggle and get a chance to really work his way through that kind of stuff. Are there better organizations he could have landed in terms of player development? Yeah, for sure. But I really thought there was a good chance that he would land in, like, I don't know, San Diego or the Dodgers, because everyone lands with the Dodgers, or some other contender who needed a bat. There was talk about Seattle being interested, and that he was going to show up, spend spring training striking out constantly, and find a team that suddenly isn't sure how to use him because they can't afford to be giving away plate appearances when they're trying to win a division. The White Sox will give him the time to adjust, and I think he's going to need some time to adjust. And on top of that, if he does adjust and starts smashing the ball, they're going to trade him to a better lineup because it's only a 2-year contract and they're not going to be good next year either. So I have to imagine the White Sox viewed this as, we're going to buy a prospect. We're going to try to get some production out of him this year. And then as soon as we can trade him for more future value, we're going to. That's my read on this. That's how I would be treating it if I were them. And so I really, really like this from a fantasy perspective for Murakami because of all those reasons.
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense from a fantasy perspective. Going to the White Sox, I think in this one very unique circumstance, yeah, is actually a huge boost. I mean, you and I talked about it a few weeks ago. Depending on where he went, there was a chance where, like, you know, he might start the year in the minors, right? Obviously, that would kill any fantasy value whatsoever for a guy that people had really cooled on. And this isn't so much to do with him going to the White Sox, but more a news piece that I think will help his value, is that I'm not so sure. I haven't followed the thread that much, but there was that piece of information that came out that on pitches over 93 miles an hour, he hit, like, you know, 195 or whatever. But then I thought I saw another, and I'll follow up on this, another tweet that, like, yeah, but on pitches 95 miles an hour and up, he hit like 250 or something. So, like, markedly better than that misleading number from before. Yeah. So now I'm thinking, like, all right, this guy is in a train wreck, and now he's got a chance. He's not going to be in the minors. He's going to be in the middle of a lineup in a pretty good park, like you said.
Yeah, and I think the challenge with that velocity stat is, first of all, you're right. The initial stat that got sort of shared and reported, it sounds like, was just factually wrong. The other thing is, there just isn't a lot of velocity in the Japanese league. It's not a high velo league like it is here. And so every player coming over from Japan at some level should be treated like they might struggle with high velocity, because they just don't see it that often. And so even if his stats against high velocity are not good, they're in small samples. It's not something it's just not a thing he focused on or should have focused on. And so that's sort of where I get this, like, he needs to make some adjustments. I think the bigger concerns now, having sort of read more about that data point, are that apparently his zone contact rate is awful. And he does strike out a ton. And those are things that are, you know, they're hard to come back from. I mean, the comps on this guy, when you look at those kinds of things, is including his power, are guys like Joey Gallo. And we know what the good version of Joey Gallo is, and we know what the bad version of Joey Gallo is, and we don't know which version Murakami is. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I have concerns. I think for me, my interest in him is going to be entirely based on price. So, like, NFBC right now, his ADP is 234.9. That's probably an okay price to pay. He's the 233rd player off the board. Other guys around him, let's just go from like 229 down. Anthony Santander going a few picks before him. I would rather take Santander for this year for sure. Austin Wells, catcher, is a whole different story. Matthew Boyd, Jose Caballero, Murakami, Spencer Steer, Logan Ohapi, Mickey Moniak, Jorge Polanco, Kyle Manzardo. Looking at that, I think if I were drafting in those leagues, I just would end up not having Murakami there. I don't think I'm going to pay that price when those other guys are on the board. Willier Abreu is going 243, 10 picks later. I'd rather take Willier Abreu for sure. But in something like an auto new league, if he's going for $15 because he's viewed as like this elite prospect coming over, I'm out. If I can get him for like less than $5, think about him as a guy who hit well in AAA with strikeout issues, who you know is going to get run this year. What would you pay for that? And I think I would go for, you know, I'm not going to go to double figures for him, but if I can get him inexpensively, I will, because I think there's a lot of upside in the bat.
Yeah, that I agree with all that. And I did find that tweet I was talking about. It's from Peter Apple, who's the co-founder of Just Baseball. On pitches 93 miles an hour or higher, it was actually a 231 average with an 833 OPS. And on 95 and up, it was a 263 average with an 826 OPS. And he says, I don't know where that 095 stat came from. So just so that our listeners are not victims of fake news, those are more accurately reported stats on Murakami. Yeah.
So let's jump to another transaction here. Staying in the AL Central, two transactions in Detroit. They re-signed Kyle Finnegan, who they acquired from the Nationals last year at the deadline. And then they signed Kenley Jansen. this one, the Tigers, I think it's like the president of baseball operations had said they have four guys who can close. It's going to be up to Hinch. They may not name a closer. I'm skeptical. I don't know what you're thinking, Pete. How are you viewing this Tigers bullpen now with Kenley there? And what does this do to keeper value for someone like Will Vest?
Well, let me start with Vest, just because that's one that's tough for me. Like I have an ugly ninth keeper situation in listener league number two. And it's like between Kobe Mayo, whose value took a torpedo with Pete Alonso showing up. Will Vest, who I have at this point no interest in keeping, and Royce Lewis, who's like a value but like not a great one. So that's my long way of saying I think Will Vest is out of the picture for keeper leagues. Look, he could end up leading this bullpen in saves, but that would really surprise me. I think it's just going to Kenley Jansen. Like, he was pretty good last year. He's a borderline Hall of Famer. He's like two saves away from passing what's his face? Help me out, Chad.
This up, because I'm not actually sure who's next in line for him.
Lee, I think.
Lee Smith?
Either one. Lee Smith. There it is. I kept wanting to say
Cliff Lee. He is two saves behind Lee Smith. The other number that I think is important, and it's not like, you know, this isn't 3,000 hits or 500 home runs or any other number you want to put out there, but he is 24 saves away from being the third player in baseball history to cross 500 saves.
Mm-hmm.
Rivera and Hoffman are the two ahead of him. Just to be clear, like, Kenley Jansen will finish his career with the third most saves in Major League history, unless something crazy happens and Craig Kimbrel comes back and gets a like 40 saves this year or something. He theoretically could do something, but Jansen has a real shot at 500 saves. Hoffman and Rivera are both over 600. Jansen's not getting there. But yeah, I mean, I think he is at a point in his career where I suspect Kenley Jansen is focused on, at some level, two things. One, I think he probably wants to win a ring. He was with the Dodgers in 2020, right? For the shortened season championship. Mm-hmm. So he does have a ring. Maybe he doesn't care about that then. He probably wants to make whatever money he can make while he's still got a chance. And I think he's worried about his legacy. I think he's trying to build a Hall of Fame case. And I think he has a valid one. And I think 500 saves, while not being sort of a hallowed number in baseball history, is those round numbers, they help. They matter. And so I think he would not have likely gone to a team that wasn't either a super clear, like, would he have gone back to the Dodgers if they said, look, you're not going to be the closer, but we'd love to have you in the bullpen? Maybe. I don't think he went to Detroit without a pretty good feeling that he had a shot to get his 24 saves he needs. And that means he's expecting, I'm guessing, and I am purely speculating here, but I'm guessing that he is under the impression that he's going to close, and I don't know why he wouldn't.
You go by the names, obviously he deserves the job, but like, this isn't like he like went to Cleveland and it's like, obviously there's Cade Smith, who's an up and comer,
right?
Even like the Cubs, where like, if he went there, I think he'd close, but it'd be like, hey man, Danny Palencia just had a great year. He's much younger. He's the future, right? He's good. Kyle Finnegan had a terrific, and I'm like laughing as I say it, he had a terrific 18 innings for Detroit last year. Like mean that, he did. He's also 34 years old, and he's got a career whip of 1.28. And guess what his whip was for Washington last year for much more than 18 innings, for 39 innings? It was 1.28. Like, I'm not saying Kenley Jansen's blowing the doors off of everybody these days. He's not. But like, even if you remove the names, he's a better candidate to close than Kyle Finnegan. So I think if you did have Kenley in like a really deep keeper, maybe you got him super cheap because it's Kenley Jansen. Like,
yeah,
I think his value went up because he has a closer's job. Like, I view him as having that job regardless of what was said about the manager making the decision. Why would he not choose Kenley?
No, I agree. And I have a $5 Will Vest in our auto new 5x5 league, that podcasters league, and a $5 even part-time closer is valuable enough that I may hold on to him there just at least long enough to see what goes on. Because if it's a timeshare, if he's second in line and is going to vulture 10 saves over the year, that's worth $5. It just is in that format. Yeah, I think Kenley's the guy. I would be treating him like the guy. I think it's worth noting that as great as Finnegan was in those, like you said, 18 innings with Detroit, in the postseason, he pitched another 7 1/3 innings with a mid-3s ERA, 3.68 strikeouts per nine. It's not like he turned some corner and became a different pitcher. He had 18 really good innings, and he had 7 where he went back to sort of being a slightly worse version of what he had already been. And I'm not saying that those 7 innings means he's bad now. I don't think there's some big gains there.
Chad, what is better? What is a better whip? Kenley Jansen's career whip or his whip last season in 2025?
I'm going to guess his whip last season in 2025.
Right, because it makes for a better point. And it is. His career whip is 0.962. His whip last year was 0.95. Like,
yeah,
he's pretty good. He's going to close.
Jansen's just sort of going. I think that's right. Let's jump to another guy. Another guy in this case staying home. That's Kyle Schwarber. I don't think this moves the needle much because I just sort of always assumed he'd end up back in Philly. So I don't know if there's a ton to talk about here. Like, Schwarber is as good a bat as there is in MLB without the name Shohei Ohtani or Aaron Judge. Like, that's about it. Like, he's good. He's staying in a good park. I do think it is worth noting that last year was like an outlier good year for Schwarber, and there's probably some regression coming, but
yeah.
If you have a keeper price, you should keep him.
Yeah, it was definitely an outlier year, but it at least in one way returned to a norm, which was like a 240, 250 batting average instead of what he had been doing in Philadelphia. So in that sense, I even feel better about him. I think the only question about Schwarber is like, Is he a second round pick now? And I think if you're in an OBP league instead of average, I think he's a first round pick despite the utility designation. So, Kyle Schwarber should still be good.
Yeah, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep moving through some of these transactions and who we think are some risers and potentially fallers from keeper values. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Next on our list of transactions to talk about as we look for risers and fallers and values, Michael King. Looked like he was long gone from San Diego, and he's not. Signed it's a three-year deal, but it's a three-year deal structured. Like, it's an interesting one because he gets, like, escalating amounts of money year over year, basically, if he sticks around. So it is clearly designed for him to have a pillow contract, and if it goes well, he'll be gone, and if not, he gets some security. Does this do anything for you with King?
No, not really. I like Michael King. I know he's an injury risk, but I'm done talking about that. I think every pitcher is just a huge injury risk. So whatever, if he's healthy going into the year, I'm excited about Michael King. I think it's bigger for San Diego than it is for Michael King's value. Cause I don't know who the hell was going to pitch for them, but now at least they got somebody.
They got somebody, him and Pivetta.
That's right.
Yeah. I think there are two things about this that I think are good for King. And it has moved him up a little bit in my estimation. The first thing about it that's good is San Diego's a good park to pitch in. Like, he could have landed in a bad park to pitch in. He didn't. That's good. And so, like, a week ago, I had to be hedging a little bit on where I thought he might land. Now I know, and it's not a bad place to land. So that's good. The other thing is, as you said, he's had some injury issues. He was injured last year. You have to worry about those injury things. There is no team in baseball who is more familiar with or aware of his injury risks than the Padres. Their doctors were the ones who worked with him all last year. Their trainers were the ones who worked with him all last year. If they think he's worth this contract, and remember, this contract is structured in a way that him getting injured is kind of disastrous for them, right? If he gets injured and is ineffective, they're paying him $75 million for nothing. If he's great, they pay him $22 million and he walks away, and that's not a they will take that, right? They'll take that's a great outcome for them. But there's some risk here if he has a bunch of injuries over the time. And so there is a part of me that thinks of all the front offices to look at him and say, we're willing to take this risk. We think he's going to be good this year. it does mean something that San Diego's was the one that did it. Now, maybe it's just because they were desperate for pitching. It's like, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but anytime a guy goes back to a team that knows them well, it makes me think that that team feels good about them, and that team is in as good a position as any to feel good about him. So that was the thing that sort of bumped him up a little bit for me. Another pitcher, this one is a pitcher who is on the move, Shane Baz. We're going to get into our rundown of Tampa Bay trades. Shane Baz off to Baltimore for a slew of prospects. It's interesting. These prospects, they're not like, you know, it's not Basayo, it's not even Mayo, but like, I think it's two first round picks were in there, like last year's and the year before or something like that. Like there's some real names here. Baltimore did not give up, you know, a bunch of nobodies to bring in Baz. That's at least a little interesting, right?
Yeah. You know, they need pitching. And they went out and acquired a guy who in a playoff series would be starting their third game. So I think that's, especially in this market, that's going to cost you. I think, you know, Baltimore's in a position where like they have to start doing this. Like, all right, you brought in Taylor Ward in a 1-year contract. You brought in Pete Alonso. You gave him money that no other team in baseball is willing to give him. I shouldn't say money. You gave him the length of a contract that no other team was willing to give him. Like, it's time to win. And so giving away prospects who are 3 or 4 years away for a guy who had the prestige of Shane Baz makes sense. It is interesting. I don't know if there's anything to really, there's nothing really to dissect or read into this, but like Baz and Grayson Rodriguez, it was hard to decide like who is the number one pitching prospect and who's the number two pitching prospect when those two were at their peak of prospect value. They traded away one for a rental outfielder, and then they traded for the other after what looked like a kind of pretty much across the board a down season. He had that hot start, and then Shane Baz, you know, the wheels kind of fell off, but his pitches still look really good. I think Baltimore is going to be a fine place to pitch in, especially with ever since they moved those fences back, you know, that's been a struggle for their offensive players. So I assume their pitchers will benefit. I'm interested to see Shane Baz and, you know, in that same vein, Grayson Rodriguez get this fresh start in a new organization. I think it could work out well for the both of them.
Yeah. And I think Baz, I mean, I think the thing for Baltimore's perspective here is like last year, as you said, it felt like a down year across the board. He 2-4. His XFIP was 3.88. Sierra was 3.95. Like, I think he was a little better than people realized last year. And his fastball velocity was up. Like, there was a lot of positives there. So, yeah, anytime an organization signals that they like a player, like, that's a good sign, right? Like, it's, you know, you have to assume that the people who are running these major league organizations, like, they have a ton of information at their fingertips. They know more than we'll ever know about what's going on with these players. I like this. I like seeing teams sort of go all in for a guy like this. I don't think it moves the needle for me a ton, but it is good to see. The other Tampa Bay trade, this is the big one. Brandon Lau to Pittsburgh, Mason Montgomery to Pittsburgh. The other big piece is Burroughs, as you mentioned before, is going from Pittsburgh to Houston, and Jacob Melton, as well as Anderson Brito, I think, is the other prospect going to Tampa Bay. Other than Montgomery, who suddenly could be in a position where if he pitches better to be a closer, because there isn't really another great option in Pittsburgh, this feels kind of not great to me for all of these guys. Burroughs is going to a much worse park to hit in, or to pitch in, I mean. Melton is going to a worse park to hit in. Lau is going to a worse park to hit in. It's like everybody moved down a little bit for me.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to push back on someone going to the Pirates and that being a downgrade. I think that is a factually correct statement. even though, you know, the Rays are going to be moving back into the Trop, and that can be a tough place to hit for guys. We've seen Lau have some of the best second base fantasy seasons, some of the best second base power fantasy seasons that we've seen in a long time. So, no, I'm not excited about Brandon Lau moving. Mike Burroughs, I like the idea of getting him out of Pittsburgh. So this is just kind of like a Pittsburgh hate fest.
Why?
Well, from a 5x5 perspective, like if Paul Skeens can't even get wins in Pittsburgh, then I don't really trust Mike Burroughs too. I think Houston historically is a good, smart organization that can at times maximize what they get out of their pitchers. We've seen some failed projects there for sure, but for the guys who can be healthy, usually they can get something pretty good out of them. I mean, we saw great strides from a lot of different people, like Christian Javier from where he started to where he ended up before getting injured, Framber Valdez from where he started with his control to where he ended up. Like, I kind of trust the Houston operation there. And I like Mike Burrows, man. I'm totally biased because it was some like Sunday afternoon or something, and I was just bored and I have MLB TV and I was watching him pitch and I'm like, this guy's kind of nasty. Like he's got a deep arsenal. He's got two pretty good pitches. The slider and the changeup. The fastball is not good, but it has velocity. So maybe there's room to grow. And that's kind of where I'm hoping Houston steps in and takes over here. They clearly see something in him to make this trade that I'm pretty sure he was the only piece they got, or he was the most significant piece they got anyway. So I don't know. It's kind of like a blind faith in both the organization, but also me liking the pitcher and just seeing, okay, this isn't really working out in Pittsburgh as well as I think it could. Let's see what he does over in Houston. So yeah. I'm going to be in on Mike Burrows again, even though there's a park downgrade.
Yeah, I think for me, I was already in, and I think Pittsburgh's pitching development's been pretty good lately, and so I have some faith in them, much like you were saying about Houston, to maximize an arm. And so I liked the situation he was in terms of the park, in terms of the division. I thought the team was a good
definitely the division
for developing pitching. Yeah,
that's a good
and
point.
So now, like, the division's worse, the park is worse, the team is better from a 5x5 perspective, but I don't know that I really trust Houston's pitching development that much more than Pittsburgh's right now. Especially given all the injuries they've had with arms, like, and the fact that they've had so many injuries that have like lingered with their hitters too. Like, I don't trust their medical staff at all. And so like that adds to it. So that's why I see this as a downgrade. But of the guys moving here, Montgomery is a guy I think has moved up in my estimation a little bit, because I think his chances of being a true closer at some point have increased. And I think Burrows has sort of fallen the least. Lau, he's getting older. He's now at a worse park to hit in, especially for power, which is his calling card. And I'm real worried about him. I think he moves down quite a bit for me in keeper value. Let's try to quickly move through a couple here. And only really talk if we think that there's something worth talking about here, but like Adolis Garcia to Philadelphia, it looks like he's going to be a starter in that outfield. It's a better park to hit in. It doesn't really change much for me.
Yeah, he seems washed, but in redraft, I like him more now than I did, you know, before that happened.
Fair enough. Edwin Diaz to the Dodgers. He has been in NFBC leagues the first closer off the board since that trade happened. That's just where he should go, right? I mean, there's not a closer we should be taking before him, is there?
I think I'd rather have Mason Miller. I mean, like, Edwin Diaz is maybe the best closer in baseball, but like, we have seen him go through bad spells before, and the Dodgers have $70 million invested in Tanner Scott. So like, I get it. I sound crazy. It's Edwin Diaz versus Tanner Scott. I'm not saying Tanner Scott is really this huge threat to Edwin Diaz, but I don't know. I'm not like losing it that he's a Dodger now. I think, you know, I think there's more of a threat to his job if he does poorly than there has been in the past. I'll put it that way.
That might be true. I just think there's more of a threat. I think it's more likely that Miller gets hurt than it is that Diaz loses the job. Even if it's more likely that
hurt. Diaz.
Fair enough. Another couple of closers moving around. Well, one moving, one staying. Raisel Iglesias staying in Atlanta, and then Robert Suarez signs in Atlanta. I'm going to do something a little weird here. First, I'm going to say, I think Raisel Iglesias is the closer there. I think they brought in
Suarez
to set him up. Right. They have said that. And I have heard on Rates and Barrels the other day, Eno and DVR both said they think Suarez ends up with more saves than Iglesias this year. I don't even think that's in the realm of possibility, to be honest, barring Iglesias getting hurt. DVR has said he thinks that Iglesias, you know, he struggled at the start of the season last year. And if that happens again, there is a replacement ready and waiting.
Sure.
I don't think that's what's going to happen. Iglesias has been fine. I think he'll continue to be fine. What I really like about this from a keeper league perspective is Iglesias is there on a one-year deal. And so when you get to the point of your draft where you're looking for good relievers who might get some saves but aren't closers, Suarez gets really interesting in keeper leagues because he could be a very useful non-closer for you and end up as a great value keeper because his price right now is nowhere near what his price will likely be 12 months from now when he's presumably the closer in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think that's great process. I won't be doing it. I really don't like Robert Suarez that much, and I've been terribly Fair wrong enough. The last 2 years. I just don't think he's as good as the numbers show, but that is good process in your keeper leagues.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I'm not even that high on him, and I'm what I'm not going to do is like push him up and take him over an actual closer. Like, I'm not doing that. But if I hit that point in my draft in a keeper league where I'm like, boy, I could use another bullpen arm. I'm going to speculate on somebody who might get saves because they're next in line. He's going to be sort of at the top of that list for me because of the long-term potential. So,
yeah.
Any of these other moves, any other moves that have happened that you think are important to talk about from a keeper value perspective?
I like Polanco getting out of Seattle, but he just had such a great year in Seattle that I don't know that I love that. So otherwise, no, not really.
City's not a great park to hit in anyways, so it's not like a huge upgrade for him. The lineup is probably better, but maybe not. I don't know.
Effect. Yeah.
Yeah. So I not a huge shift there for me. There's a bunch of smaller deals, but none of them that sort of stand out. So hopefully we have effectively answered Cool's question, and we should jump to the next question, which comes from Roadkill in the Auto News Slack. This is an interesting one. Does the possibility of a 2027 lockout change your attitude towards long-term dynasty assets? Would you, for instance, be less likely to tear a team down for future value in 2026? So, Pete, are you changing any of your strategy because a lockout might happen?
When I hear long-term keeper assets, I think of guys who are like not even on the 40 man. And if you're not on the 40 man, you're not going to be locked out. You're going to have a minor league season. So I don't know, if I had Jesus Made, right? If he is on the 40 man, my bad. I just figured he's so young. He's probably not. I'm not changing that. I'm definitely probably more likely just to keep him because unlike the rest of my roster, he's not going to be sitting on his butt. So in that way, no, not really. I think the only time this is going to come into question for me is for my keeper league teams, my long-term leagues, when if I'm out of contention and I'm selling, I'm going to start aiming for like guys who are going to be good in 2 years as opposed to just one, I guess, to answer the question. But I can't say I'm going to operate, especially here on December 22nd, any differently than I would normally.
Yeah, I'm not going to do anything different. And the reason is a little bit different, I think, than yours, but it primarily is this. I think there is a good chance of a lockout or a strike or something like that happening. But free agent contracts have been growing. Players are getting more money. The sport is bringing in more money. Everybody right now is doing pretty well, which means that there is a big incentive to get this figured out quickly. Do I think quickly means no stoppage, everything happens just as we expect? Probably not. I think there's probably going to be some delays here or there. Do I think we're going to get, let's say, 144 games or more in 2027? Yes, I do.
Oh, and I needed to hear that. That's a breath of fresh air.
That's what I think.
Bring in the flowers today.
I think there's too much at stake for them.
Sure.
Like, I think one of the things that's really different now versus like 95, right? 94, 95, where we lost, first of all, so 95, we got 144 game season. After 94, we lost the World Series. The entertainment world is way more fractured now than it was then. Baseball was actually in a stronger position as a league at that point on both the player side and the owner side to say, screw this. We're willing to like sacrifice some of the stability of our entire sport to see how this goes and to win what we're trying to win here. I don't think either side can actually afford to do that anymore because there's just too many other options out there. And like, I mean, it seems kind of silly in a way because, like, I'm a soccer fan. I'm an MLS fan. I go to a lot of soccer games. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that MLS is as big as Major League Baseball. It's not. It exists in a way that it didn't 30 years ago. And that is just another thing out there that in the summer of 2027, there will be soccer games. There will be options. There is more media available to people. Like, people have better access to other forms of baseball even, right? Like, the Savannah Bananas exist. They're not going to be locked out. Like, baseball just has more that they're competing with. And I don't think that they can afford for this to be a, like, lose the season kind of thing. And so I think we're going to get a season. And I think full season, it may not be the season we hope for. But let me tell you something. If my teams are doing poorly in 2026 and I sell off to try to win in 2027 and I get 100 games in 2027 and I win my leagues, I am celebrating that championship like any other. So,
of course.
Yeah, of course. I'm not worried about it. That's my takeaway. Let's go to one more question before our next break. Let's take this one from Kevin in our Discord. Pete, you would put out a thing that we'd put out a thing saying, hey, like, offer us trades. We'll debate them. Kevin said he'd play along. He said, for you, Pete, he has a 24th round Cal Raleigh. Would you consider trading a 21st round Corbin Carroll for Raleigh?
So, no. Here's why.
Before you get into the why, I will just note Corbin Carroll is the 7th off the board in NFBC ADP. Cal Raleigh is 17th off the board. That does, in theory, make Raleigh 3 rounds cheaper, a little bit of a better value as a keeper. Maybe. At least in theory.
In theory, yeah. I would, whoever I take in the 21st round, if they're still on my roster in September, then I should go play the lottery. So I'll put it that way, especially with a keeper league that's been around now for 4 or 5 years, whatever it's been, and has all that inflation. This league is a 5 outfielder, 1 catcher league. That really matters to me. I think last year I had like 2 catchers that were like pretty good. And then I had like Sam Basayo. I couldn't play when he got called up. Like, I can't remember exactly, but, look, if you told me that Cal Raleigh's going to do what he did in 2025 and Corbin Carroll's going to do what he did in 2025, then yeah, I'd do that trade. But yeah. I think there's a good chance that Cal Raleigh has an amazing career, is an awesome hitter for the rest of his career, and also never comes even close to doing what he did in 2025. In which case, especially with it being a roto, honestly, Corbin Carroll's be one of the most well-rounded players in all of roto, even in OBP leagues, that like I just rather have him with it being 5 outfielders, but it's a totally fair offer and I would understand somebody accepting it.
Yeah. So looking at NFBC ADP again, Raleigh is, like I said, going 17th. His min pick is 6th on Fantrax, where this league is happening. I don't have min pick data there, but he is 13th or 14th off the board. 13.7 is his ADP. And again, that does in theory make this at least a reasonable question to ask. I'm going to go a step further than you in terms of what you were saying about Raleigh and say, I think the people taking him in the second round are delusional. I think he's a terrible second round pick. I don't get it. He had a career year last year. He is not going to hit 60 home runs again. He's just not, right? And when he doesn't hit 60 home runs, he's going to have a really low batting average. And he's not going to steal any bases. Like, I don't see it. There are such better options in the second round, even in 2-catcher leagues. I'm just not taking him there. And so if I start thinking about where I would actually feel comfortable taking him, then a 24th round Raleigh versus a 21st round Carroll isn't close. It's just not. Because I think Raleigh's going 2 rounds too early, at least 1.
Yeah, I'm not going to take him where he's going. I just had the opportunity to in a gladiator league, and I ended up taking Nick Kurtz instead, who, you know, he himself has only done it for 1 year, but I'd rather have him. I think for sure. Part of it, NFBC is where we're getting most of our information right now, and all their formats are two catcher leagues. So that is definitely playing a part.
Well, that's why I pulled up. That's why I pulled up the Fangraphs or the Fantrax data, because I thought maybe Fantrax ADP would be more balanced, but he's 13th there. He's going higher there.
Interesting. I wonder, I would be interested in what the difference is between two catcher and one catcher leagues, if such a thing could be filtered. In a one catcher league, there's just no way I'm taking him in the second round. Even in a two catcher league, I'm not taking him in the second round. I think if I were to defend or understand the people that are doing it, even if you cut, let's say you shave 25 homers off of his total from last year, which is like, that's an aggressive, even if he's never going to hit 60 again, to just shave 25 off would put him at 35 homers. Could he be a 35 homer, 100 RBI, 8 stolen base instead of 14 stolen base catcher who also scores 100 runs? If he is, he could still be worth the second rounder. I'm just not willing and ready to do that, especially with how much he strikes out. That's really the kicker for me, where like, I don't trust guys who strike. I just don't trust guys who strike out that much. It's not really a hot take. It just feels like the bottom could fall out at any moment when it comes to most of these stats, because he could have a month where he hits, you know, 085 with 24 strikouts, and that's it. Like, now there's no way for you to recoup the value no matter what he does the rest of the season.
Yeah. And as we've talked about, I think catcher's kind of deep right now.
Yeah.
And so I'm willing to wait. I'm willing to wait. And we have a question coming up later. I don't know if we're going to get to it today, but we have a question coming up later about corner infield. And I think I want to be filling corner infield
before I catcher. Yeah.
Which seems crazy, but it's true. We'll save that for later though. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we have a few more questions and maybe we will talk about that corner infield one. All right. Welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Before we went into break, I said we had this question about corner infielders, and it wasn't coming up till later, but let's skip ahead to it since we were just talking about it, because I think it's relevant here. Question comes from Tyler in the Discord. Says, this is probably more general than you're looking for, but I'd like to hear about your thoughts on corner infield right now in Dynasty. Kurtz Caminero, Vladdy J-Ram, third base. Third base feels shallow this year. First base feels flat. Not tons of upside, but also not tons of downside. How do prospects look for the next couple of seasons as well at these positions? Feels like corner infield is in a really weird place to me right now. Partially a changing of the guard for some names, and also a lot of non-traditional performances from those positions as well. So let me tell you what I said, because I spent some time looking at this today. And I agree, third base feels shallow. Honestly, after Jose at the top, like your number two third baseman off the board in drafts right now is Caminero. And Junior Caminero is good. He looks like he's going to be a star. He's done it for 1 year, and he's moving into a much worse park. Now, I want to be very clear. I believe in Caminero. I don't think the park is going to be a problem for him. But this isn't your, like, I feel like usually there's like two or three guys at the top that you've got like no questions about at a position like third base, and that's not the case here. And after that, you have Machado, who's getting older and has had some down years. You have Austin Riley, who's been struggling for 2 years now. People still expect him to bounce back. I don't even know that I disagree, but then you got like, how much do you trust Michael Garcia? Eugenio, Alex Bregman don't have jobs right now. So like, you don't know what to expect from then. And then after that, you've got Nualvi Marte, Jordan Westberg, Matt Chapman, Matt Shaw. Like, that's your top 12. You're not. And like, do I feel okay about a guy like Chapman or Shaw as my starting third baseman? Do I feel like Nualvi might be a good third base option? Yeah, I don't hate those guys. But like, you're not getting yourself a guaranteed good starter outside the top few picks. It gets real, real iffy. Then you go to first base and you've got Kurtz going first over Vlad, which is bonkers to me. I would take Vlad over Kurtz. I don't know if that's a crazy take, but I would. But Vlad and Kurtz. Kurtz is another, like, he's only done it 1 year. I like him, but he's only done it 1 year. And then you have a few more guys who are quite good, right? I mean, not, you know, Pete Alonso, Bryce Harper, Matt Olson, Raffy Devers, Freddie Freeman. Then by the time you get to your eighth first baseman, you're looking at Josh Naylor. Not quite as much of a sure thing, not quite as much of a talent as those guys above him. Vinny Pascantino. Michael Bush. And now, before we've even gotten to 12, you get to Yandy Diaz, who has real warts. You've got Jonathan Aranda, whose track record is short and is moving into a much worse park. And I am more worried about the park for him than I was for Caminero. Christian Walker, who wasn't very good most of last year. Spencer Torkelson, who's been very up and down. Wilson Contreras, he's going 210th. That's going to go up. That price is going to go way up. And then you have like Sal Stewart, Spencer Steer, Kyle Mansell. Like it is somewhat flat to the point in Tyler's question. Like there's a bunch of guys there I like for different reasons. There are not a lot of guys I'm super confident in. And after those guys, now you've got like, we're looking at about 20-ish first basemen and about, I don't know, 10 to 12 third basemen. And then you're into like Jake Berger, Nolan Shanuel, like guys I have real questions about. Which means that if I wait and don't end up with, let's say, three of the top 30-ish guys at those positions, and I might not, because teams might take them for util or take backups or whatever. Like, if I don't end up, or someone might take Noelvi as a outfielder instead and still take a fourth middle. Like, if I don't end up with one of those guys, I'm getting a little nervous about my corner infield situation. And so I want to fill that out. Whereas at catcher, if I'm not going to get Raleigh at the top and I'm not going to pay for Raleigh at the top, like, I'm sort of okay if I get Alejandro Kirk as the 12th catcher off the board. I'm sort of okay if I get, Carter Jensen, Francisco Alvarez, who are the 16th and 17th catchers off the board. I think Ryan Jeffers is the 23rd catcher off the board is not a terrible option. I think Sean Murphy could have a bounce back season. He's the 28th catcher off the board. Do I think Sean Murphy is as good as some of those corner infield options? No, he's not. But he's closer to being where the top catchers are, not the top catchers, but he is closer to being a viable catcher than the next tier of corner infields are to being a viable corner infielder. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It goes back to, you know, and this listener used the same word, but you used it earlier and I liked it for catcher, that catcher gets flat. And yeah, the flatness is like higher up than it's been in the past where like, I don't want in a two catcher league, I don't want my second catcher to be a guy who's going to hit 230 and have in the 40s in runs and RBI. Like I don't want that. Right. And in that case, to avoid that, if I thought that was going to be the case, I would be reaching on catchers. But I just think that bottom, I don't know, that like whoever catchers 15 through 20 are just seem like they're more likely to exceed those marks that we've kind of accepted from the lower end.
Kyle Teal, Francisco Alvarez, Carter Jensen, Dylan Dingler, JT Realmuto, Austin Wells.
Yeah, that's like way, way stronger than the like catcher number twos that we've been dealing with in the past. So I think that's where it's coming from. In terms of the question at hand, like I have a hard time with this because in Chad, you've been playing fantasy a long time. Like in like 2007, like the idea of getting Rollins or Reyes at shortstop in the first round or getting Chase Utley at second base just felt like such a crazy advantage because consistently shortstop and second base were very thin positions for a very long time. We now do this thing. And when I say we, I mean the collective we, the fantasy baseball community we, where like a few years ago it was outfield. Before that it was third base. Every year it's second base. And we're like, oh, this position's going to suck. It's going to be horrible. We got to do this, that, and the other thing. And this isn't helpful analysis going into draft season because it's like, okay, well, great. It's going to work out in the end, but still, who do I take? You know what I mean?
Right.
But it does lead me to, in a larger sense, not overly worry about position scarcity. Like it's there, it's going to be there for certain positions every single year. Nowadays it tends to jump from position to position. I couldn't believe it was outfield a few years ago, but it was outfield. And then we got Jackson Merrill and Jackson Churio and, you know, all these other outfielders coming out of nowhere. So I hear it, you know, and it's not helpful to just be like, oh yeah, third base looks thin, but it's probably going to end up perfectly fine. Cause then that still doesn't help. At the same time, find your targets and you should be okay, or at least better off than you would think. And that like, you know, most listeners are probably playing in like 12 team leagues. So odds are that you're going to have one of those 1 through 8 at first base. And I think all 8 of those, and actually I'm going to add Naylor in there too. I think those 9 are awesome. So you have like a 75% chance, and maybe it isn't that good because somebody said, like you said, could double up on a first baseman.
Yeah.
That like your first baseman in a 12-team league, if you have one of those nine guys, is going to be pretty damn good. So most leagues also count corner infield. You know, you still do have to fill third base, and you still then have to worry about the positions like catcher and second base where the numbers aren't as high as, you know, those other positions. But it's just not something I tend to overemphasize in my drafts. Back in the day, sure, but now I just can't do it.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that for me, second base is the only position I'm like really concerned about because I think second base is really ugly right now.
Yeah, it's tough.
Third base is, I do feel some urgency. And I'm like, I'm not doing any redraft this year. Everything's keeper. And so in my keeper leagues, like I'm trying to get myself via trade a third baseman I feel good about. I don't want to go into auctions needing third base because I think there's going to be a lot of auctions or drafts in keeper leagues without a viable third base option. Like there just aren't enough of them, right? And so you are right that like, again, if I stick with the NFBC stuff, I can scroll down and say like, okay, you know, Itzhak Paredes exists and is in that group. Addison Barger's a little lower down. You mentioned Royce Lewis earlier as being a guy who like, what am I going to do with him? I don't know. You scroll down, maybe Mark Vientos is interesting. I like Brett Beatty, although he has second base everywhere, so I'm probably using him there. Alec Bohm actually was pretty strong then the season last year. Like there are guys.
Muncy before his injury yeah. Looked like he was back.
But you have to go through those guys and you're going to find for yourself, there's like two of them that you trust. And if the top five or six third basemen are kept and the two guys that you trust are kept, then you're stuck just grabbing whoever. And it makes me a little nervous. I mostly like to have my rosters, like my lineups pretty well filled out before auctions, but like I can go into an auction knowing I need like to spend on a big outfield bat or two big outfield bats and feel pretty good that there will be options available. Right now, I feel like I can do that at first base. Right now, I feel like I can do that at catcher. Like if I need a catcher, I feel like I can go find a catcher in an auction. I may have to pay a premium for them, but I'm fine with that. Second base as well. But third base, I do start to feel a little bit like, man, like, I don't know. I don't know that I really trust Michael Garcia. If he's the top 10 third baseman that's available, I don't feel good about having to spend for him, which means that I won't. Someone else will outbid me because I just won't feel good about it. And so like, I want to go and like, if there's a reasonably priced Austin Riley, if I can get Jose Ramirez or Caminero, I like Noelvi Marte and Addison Barger. And I like the fact that they can move to the outfield as well. Like, there's some guys I'm willing to, like, I want to go, I'd rather go get those guys now and not worry about it at auction.
That makes sense.
Because of how weird the position is right now. All right, Pete, I think we have time for one more question. Let's take this one from Ethan Hunt on the Auto News Slack. What strategies do you employ to switch your mindset for evaluating your Auto News teams in different formats? I struggle with evaluating my 5x5 team and then switching to 4x4 or points. I focus more on 5x5, so values from that format bleed over when I'm looking at other rosters. And I like this because like this is one thing for Auto New where there's four different formats, but like I'm playing in five Auto New leagues this year. Three are 4x4, one is head-to-head points, one is 5x5. I am in our two listener leagues, one of which is 5x5 Roto, the other is a 5x5 categories head-to-head, and they have different stats. I am in a 6x6 head-to-head league on CBS. I've got my dynasty league on Fantrax, which is 5x5, but it's OBP, so it's not traditional 5x5. It's also, is it saves plus holds? I think it's saves plus holds, and it's wins plus quality starts. Other than my three auto new 4x4 leagues, no two of leagues that I'm in have the same stats. They're just all different. So here are my things. First is you have to just know your valuations, and I would put things down as much as you can in writing. That might mean like using the Fangraphs auction calculator and just saving a spreadsheet of the values that it spits out, but have something in writing so that when you are thinking about a league, you have something you can look at to anchor yourself that isn't just your gut or what you were thinking about yesterday or the player you thought about the day before. Like, give yourself something to reset your thinking. I also like where I can to keep my values in a single sheet. Like, it's useful for me to be like, oh, I have Addison Barger at X dollars in 5x5 and Y dollars for this league and Z dollars for this league, because it helps me to think about why those things are different to see them next to each other. So those are things I like to do. Some general thoughts here. Roto leagues versus point leagues. Roto leagues are going to have flatter value curves because there are different ways for a player to get value. There's more balance. And so what do I mean by that? If you have a guy who in a 5x5 league is like a guy in a 5x5 league could be worth $10 because he has a high average and high stolen bases and scores a lot of runs. And he can also be worth $10 because he gets a lot of home runs and a lot of RBIs with a lot of runs. Right? Two different ways of getting $10. It is really hard to parse between those two guys because they're both worth $10, and which one you need might depend on your roster construction and all this other stuff. In a points league, those things can all be calculated to points. And I can tell you exactly how many points an extra RBI is worth compared to an extra stolen base. Right? And that means that every player can actually be stack ranked. Now, obviously, projections are not super precise, and just because I think a guy is worth X points and doesn't mean that he is, and there can be debate there, but you do have a very clear delineation of who is worth more at the end of the season. And because of that, once you hit, it's more clear where replacement level is, right? So in a 5x5 league, there might be a bunch of guys who are really close to replacement level because this guy's replacement level because of stolen bases, and this guy's the replacement level guy you want for RBIs, and this is the replacement level guy you would pick up to boost your batting average. In points, that doesn't work. In points, only one of those guys is worth having, and the other ones are less valuable. And so you end up with a flatter value curve. That typically will mean that the top-end guys are worth less. So like Aaron Judge might be worth less in 5x5 than he is in points. Juan Soto is worth less in 5x5 than he is points. But that middle tier is actually deeper, right? So there are going to be more guys. There might be fewer guys, using Otto New as an example here. There might be fewer guys worth $70. There might be nobody worth $70 in a Roto League while there is in points. There will be more guys worth like $15 to $20 to $25. There'll be more guys in that space. And then it'll cross over again at some point later, but then the long tail of guys worth $1 is longer for those Roto leagues than it is for those points leagues, because again, you might want a guy for a buck because he provides a certain category that doesn't matter in points. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other things to keep in mind as you're going from league to league: weekly versus daily lineups. Weekly leagues have a higher replacement level because platoon guys aren't worth as much, and you don't need as many guys in your roster, right? You're only going to use the guys you're going to use each week. Head-to-head leagues, lower replacement level. This depends a little bit on structure, but in general, in head-to-head leagues, there's usually not games played limits. It means that you want to fill out as many games as you can, which means you want a deeper roster. And that's another thing. If your league is like an Otto New league where there's 162 games per position, that's different than if you're in a league with no games played cap and you can get as many games played as you want. If you have no games played cap, depth matters. Get every guy in the lineup every day. Maximize those stats as much as you can. It changes replacement level in that way. It's also true, though, in Roto leagues, you have rate stats. And because you have rate stats, you don't necessarily want to fill out your roster every day, right? The guy that... like a bad player in a 5x5 league might actually hurt you. And it's even more true in Otto New 4x4, where two of the offensive stats are rate stats. A bad player will hurt you. In a points league, the bad player is still over time going to be worth more than nothing, right? It's like in a Otto New points league, fill out every single game you can. Just do it. 4x4, it's not as important. 5x5, it's more borderline because four of the five stats are counting stats. So it might still be a good thing to do. So yeah, those are, I think, some of the things I think about. If your starting point, which is where Ethan's coming from, is 5x5 and you're trying to figure out how to think about points or 4x4, like you want to ignore stolen bases, but don't just ignore stolen base guys. Like, don't think this guy's valuable because of his stolen bases. Therefore, he's not valuable in these other formats. Because a lot of guys who steal bases also score a lot of runs. They also have high on base percentages. They may bring other things to the table. And so you want to make sure you're actually looking at the full player. And that gets back to the first thing I said, which is have your values written down in a spreadsheet somewhere you can look them up so that you're not just vibesing on it. You're actually like reacting to some numbers. That's my speech.
I'm a pretty big vibes guy myself when it comes to auctions, but I think this is like the lame.
Let me just clarify. I think going on vibes is fine as long as what you're vibesing on is the right thing. So if you're starting from a point of like, man, in this points league, it says that Kyle Stowers is worth $13, but like I'm super high in him. I really think he's gonna have a good year. I think he's gonna keep up what he's been doing. I'm willing to break the bank for him. That's fine. You could do that. I do that too. What you don't want to do is be like, yeah, I was like super excited about Chandler Simpson because it's, you know, my 5x5 league, he's worth a ton and I'm super excited about him. And like, I'm willing to break the bank for him. And then you do that in a 4x4 league. Like, that's not a good idea. You started from the wrong valuation. Right. And so it is. Don't vibes on your starting point. Give yourself something to anchor off of that is a legitimate, like, this is what I think this guy's value is objectively using my brain, not my gut. And then if you want to pivot off that because the vibes feel good, go for it. I'm all for that. But start with something more rational.
Yeah, I think, you know, the most helpful feedback for this question is probably what you said in terms of just like when it's time for the auction or time for the draft, like you have put in the work to write down your values for players specific to that format, right? I think a lot of this will just come from experience too. Like, I'm still learning in new 4x4. Like, I love ground ball pitchers, but ever since I started playing new 4x4, I have been a fiend on who the heck is a ground ball pitcher and who isn't. Like, new 4x4 has gotten me to almost appreciate Brian Bello. Like, that's
almost
and like that it has almost got me to appreciate Logan Webb. Like, I'm coming around on these horrible pitchers because this particular format is kind of forcing me to do that, and I've learned just through playing it, which again isn't super helpful, but that's the truth. And I mean, it's important to identify why this is the case. Most fantasy analysis and everything revolves around roto. It revolves around 5x5 roto. And as a person who predominantly plays head-to-head categories, I think those two get lumped in too much together. If you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know I feel that way, that like head-to-head categories and roto just get lumped in together, and it's like you use the same rank. That's just not the right way to go about strategizing. I understand rankings being the same for both, because at the end of the day, the categories are the categories, but in terms of how you strategize and build your team, they're very different. So it matters to have a plan, and that's my long way of saying that's why you should listen to Keeper Cut, because this is what we did. We break down these differences. We play in all these different kinds of leagues. And I think just the more you expose yourself to it and the more you play it, that's really where the help is going to come from. But what Chad said, especially when it comes to writing down values and having an idea of in your head, here is my plan for this auction, because in this particular format, Chandler Simpson is worth a 15th round pick. In this format, he is not even worth a dollar. And just having that in your head is really important.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess, of course, I think it's right. I said it. So it'd be weird if I was like, you know what? Now that you said it, Pete, I'm out. I don't know.
Sounds worse when I say it. Yeah,
I will say I playing all of these different formats, I do think, and this is sort of Ethan's point of Ethan's question, I think, I do think playing all these different formats makes it harder for me to be successful as a fantasy player.
Oh, because definitely.
There's so many different things to keep in mind. However, I also think it's just way more fun. It keeps things interesting. I like having the variety. And so I would rather play a bunch of different formats, even if it takes a little extra work and even if it makes it a little bit harder. As I've gotten older and had less time to do that extra work. It's made it even more of a problem, but I still just like, it's more fun. I will like, I cut back this year. I'm going to have fewer leagues this year than I've had before. In that cutting back, I didn't actually really cut back on formats very much, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm playing almost as many different kinds of leagues. I got rid of at least two or three pure 5x5 leagues. And yeah, I got rid of one Fangraphs points league. I kept to different ones. Like I kept a lot of the variety because variety is the spice of life, Pete. So,
well, it's we got really deep this episode.
I think that's what happens when we are still recording after 1 a.m. Eastern time. Pete, I appreciate you making it a late night. I still need to get this thing edited before I get to bed. So we're going to let our listeners go. We're going to let ourselves go. If you left us a question and we didn't get to it, which is almost all of you, I said we would get to at least three. We got to five. Good job, us. We'll try to get to the rest in the future. Next episode, we'll go through a lot more of these, and we spent a big chunk today on that transactions question. That won't take up as much time next time, hopefully. So, yeah, thank you all for listening. We'll be back with you. Happy New Year. Happy holidays. Hope you have some good times with your family, and we'll talk to you in 2026.